सहनावतु सहनौभुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Today's questions. I recognize from their appearance. So there are four questions here. We'll start. Take one at a time. Is it Ishvara's grace to appreciate the removal of obstacles to one's understanding of unattached Satchit Ananda at the mental level? Our understanding, we need not the mental level, etc. Meaning that if the question is, if obstacles are removed, the obstacles to our knowledge, if those obstacles are removed, should we consider that as Ishvara's grace, meaning that grace or favor of Ishvara? Yes, surely. We jokingly said that devatas, as you said in the morning, do not like that we are pursuing the knowledge. That's a way of saying. And so, those who can create obstacles are those who also can remove obstacles. There in the commentary of the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad where this discussion comes, where the Upanishad says in its words that devatas do not like that human beings pursue the knowledge of Brahman. Shankara said, the meaning is that we should please the devatas. We should make the devatas favorable to us so that we achieve or acquire their grace. This devata in terms of different gods, different deities, is a matter of belief. Meaning that, worshipping God can be in different ways and will depend upon one's cultural and religious upbringing. Meaning that every religious tradition prescribes a way of worshipping Ishvara. And that's fine. As far as worship is concerned, it can be anything. What is important is that you worship. In which form you worship, in which language you worship, etc., is not important as much as that you worship. But that should be worship of Ishvara in our life, one form or the other. Even for the seeker of knowledge, the worship should be there. Prayer should be there because we always need favor or grace. From our own self, in fact, our own mind becomes a big obstacle. And devatas become obstacle, not God alone knows, but our own mind is the biggest obstacle. Lord Krishna said in the Gita, as we say in the morning also, that our mind can be our benefactor or our mind also can be our enemy. And so, the mind which is in the control of the impulses, such as kama, krodha, lova, craving, anger, greed, that mind acts as though it is my enemy. And so to release the mind from the hold of those enemies, and we require the grace of Ishvara. And therefore, there is always room for prayer and room for achieving or acquiring the grace of Ishvara. It is hard to say whether a given thing is because of what. That my obstacles are removed, is it the result of the grace of Ishvara? In words of our Swami, you will say, it is a graceful way to say that it is grace of Ishvara. Because there is no other way for us to determine that we cannot arrive at the cause of any happening. So if some favor happens in our life, we cannot say it is this and not something else. But then a graceful way is that it is Ishvara's grace. That way, we accept our limitation. We have a sense of humility, sense of gratitude, and we accept our limitation and the need for help. And that's how we give credit to Ishvara. That's the best way. Rather than saying, I did something and I got the result. Best way is that is Ishvara's grace. Other question, it seems similar. How would we appreciate Ishvara's grace or help in the spiritual path? For a degree of detachment, right, associated with higher chakra or heart, head in the body, etc., etc. Well, whatever our understanding is of what we call self-growth or spiritual growth, whatever our understanding is. So different traditions may express it different way. Some tradition may say that rising from one chakra to other is called progress. Vedanta simply would say that purification of mind is progress. Because purer the mind is, closer you find yourself to Ishvara or to yourself. And ultimately, you have to recognize yourself as Ishvara. So closer you are, better it is. So that's called progress. So anyway, you can say that the progress that a person makes in one's spiritual growth is definitely the grace of Ishvara. Viveka Chudamani says, Muktirno Shata Janma Koti Shata Sakrutai Punye Vinalabhyate Jantunam Narajanma Durlabham. Even to gain the human embodiment itself is rare and due to grace of Ishvara. That billions of people have. Tatah Pumstvam Tato Viprata. That to have a spirit of growing and making this life really successful, that spirit is even rare for the grace. Viprada, then to have a religiosity in the life, include the worship of God, etc., study of scriptures, even rare. Humstam tato viprada, tasmad vaidika dharma marga parata. As a result of studying the textbooks, religious textbooks, to put them into practice and live the life of worship, life of dharma, is even rare. Because many people know what is right, but not necessarily live what is right, for whatever reasons. So to know what is right is of course very important, but then to live that life is even more rare. Tasmad vaidika dharma argvarta vidvatvam asmat param. Then to study Vedanta, listen to scriptures, is even rare. Atmanatma vivechanam, and thus carrying out the vivechanam, discrimination between the non-self and the non-self, is even further rare. And to gain the knowledge, abiding in knowledge, even most rare. Mukti, meaning liberation, characterized by an abidance in knowledge, is the most rare. All of this is the result of the fructification of countless virtuous deeds that we would have done in the past. So any good turn that happens in our life can be said to be the result of the grace of Ishvara. Although you can say that it is a virtuous deed that I perform in the past, therefore I am doing it. That's not a graceful way of saying. Graceful way of saying is, it is grace of Ishvara. As Goswami is aware, it's not that Ishvara in the morning sits down and says, let me distribute grace like that. Certainly, the grace, we also have some contribution in terms of performing, living life of dharma and whatever. But then, ultimately it is grace of Ishvara. So any kind of progress, even the progress, the material progress also is Ishvara's grace. Then what to talk of the spiritual progress? So material progress can be in terms of the material wealth. Spiritual progress can be in terms of the inner wealth. What Lord Krishna calls the Devi Sampada, divine wealth. In terms of those good qualities. Ahimsa, Satyam, Akrodha, non-violence, truthfulness, non-anger. Lord Krishna described them as divine virtues. That's real wealth. And all of that is due to grace of Ishvara. Can you please elaborate on specific benefit of direct Om meditation and the reflection on being in silence, Turiya? Well, that's a benefit. Being in silence itself is the final result, you know. So, direct Om meditation, I guess this question may be because you have started studying the Mandukya Upanishad. I don't know how far have you come in that.
It's still beginning only.
So how did this Om meditation come? I don't know. But anyway, Mandukya Upanishad in fact unfolds the meaning of Om. It is its own prakriya, its own method which Mandukya provides. That Om is just a sound really. It is what you may call a meaning like word in Puja Swami. All these are all what called Bija Mantra. Bija Mantra means those sounds which carry specific energy with them. So there are some 16 different Bija Mantras and each one has its own energy, they say, and therefore each of those mantras may be associated with a given deity which represents that energy. So, Goddess Saraswati represents one energy, Lakshmi represents another energy, Durga represents another energy, Krishna represents. So, with different devatas you associate. So, that all comes later. So, the devatas giving the form, etc., comes a little later, but that's how you. So, each of those sounds which we find in the Vedas, each one it represents the energy. So also Om. But Om in particular, because in Vedas, Om has been given the greatest importance of all other sounds. It's said even that Om is a primordial sound from which the whole universe emerges also. And therefore, Om is prescribed as what you meditate upon, as the object of meditation. So you just take Om and look upon, just worship Om as God. Like you worship a murti as God. You can worship Om, that very sound also. So thus you superimpose the idea of Ishvara upon Om and repeat in your mind. So repeating that also is meditation. Second stage will be to understand the meaning of. So then Om, first level of meditation for Om, is worshipping Ishvara through this Om as representing Ishvara. So when you meditate upon Krishna, Rama or whatever our samskaras are, that represents Ishvara. So also in the Vedic times, so this sound and some other were also prescribed as effective means of meditation, and Om is considered the most effective way of all the sounds. So Kathopanishad also will say, Yadadhyavaksharam brahma, Yadat Devaksharam Param. So Om can be meditated upon as Saguna Brahma or qualified Brahman. Or can be meditated upon as the unqualified Brahman also. Depending upon our own preparation of mind and depending on what it is that we are seeking. And the result is in accordance with your prayer, worship. So basically this meditation is the form of worship, understand? So first level of meditation is worshipping Ishvara with Om as a symbol. Second level of meditation is understanding what Om stands for, and that is the self. Om is a sound, represents what we call Saguna Brahma or qualified Brahman. And then the gap between the two utterances Om symbolizes the Nirguna Brahma or Brahman, which transcends all the attributes. Thus Om can become the means. We'll talk about that also. And so that is how the Om meditation is. And yes, it is certainly much prescribed and certainly very effective. But these meditations become more effective as we understand Vedanta more and more clearly. And particularly Mandukya Upanishad, that our Vijayaji has started teaching. So that unfolds the meaning of Om, Akara, Ukara, Makara, and so on, that you will see. In the Gita, Lord Krishna tells Arjuna that the enemy has already been killed. There's a dialogue in the Bhagavad Gita where this is what Lord Krishna says to Arjuna in the 11th chapter of the Gita, when Lord Krishna shows his cosmic form, because Arjuna requested the Lord to show his cosmic form, because Lord said, I am the whole universe, the self of the whole universe. You are the self of the whole universe. You sustain the entire universe. I like to see that. And so Lord Krishna shows in the cosmic form. And Arjuna is, naturally, he starts praising that form. And slowly the form starts becoming ferocious. And slowly that form turns into nothing but embodiment of death. And Arjuna sees both the warriors of both the armies walking into the jaws of the death of Lord. And is frightened. Says, Lord, why have you presented such a frightening form before me? I didn't ask for this. I said, what have you asked for? This is, So then Lord Krishna says that, right now I have presented myself before you as nothing but embodiment of death, Kalaha, or the principle of death. And I'm determined to devour both the armies, and nobody is going to be saved from this army, whether you fight or not. And therefore you better stand up and fight and get the credit for winning this battle. Because in fact all of these are already killed by me. So that was the purpose of showing Arjuna how the warriors of both armies were walking into the mouth of Lord Krishna as the death. Means has already happened. Then what do you have to do? What do I have to do? You get the credit. Because the world will think that you have killed all of them. You have to kill only those who are already killed. But I have chosen you to get all the credit and fame. So Arjuna, you are the chosen one for getting the fame. So it is true. It's a way of, a matter of interpretation. This question of the question, do we have free will? This question. Ultimately, everything is God's will, as nothing can be against His will. So it depends on in what spirit we are saying this. If by saying everything is God's will, there's no free will, there's no responsibility, then we say, now there is free will. Take responsibility for what you do. When Lord Krishna says, karmanyavadikaraste, meaning that you have the responsibility of doing the right action. Take the responsibility. Because you give up the responsibility. So when Arjuna gave up the responsibility while laying down his arms, then Lord Krishna takes the responsibility. When he's ready to take responsibility, then he says, hey, you recognize that you don't do anything. Everything is done through you. Nimitta Matra may become the instrument in the hands of the Lord. So both are right, depending upon what our state of mind is. So yes, there is free will. If there is no free will, then there is no punya papa, no virtue, no vice. Then there is no karma, there is no karma phala. Meaning that as far as all creatures, other than human beings are concerned, they don't have a free will as best as we know. So there is no responsibility. They don't know anything wrong or right. What they do is okay. So if a cat makes a mouse its breakfast, it's, no, it's not a con. Violence. Doesn't get papa karma. Otherwise, they'll die. Because they always keep on killing others. Because one life form depends on other life form. If that involves papa, then the fellows, you know, will never be free from naraka. But no, there is no punya papa. Well, the human being has punya and papa, virtue and vice, because there is free will. So where is free will? And where is Ishvara's will? When we do something, what is the extent of free will and what's the extent of Ishvara's will is very difficult to determine. In right now also, what is the free will of the Swami who is talking and what is Ishvara's will, that line, you know, the dividing line we cannot determine. Because I could not talk unless you are there. You know, and so you are all Ishvara's will that you are here. I could not control that you are here or not. Is all Ishvara's will. And that I'm talking, you want to call it my will? Well, okay, but I could not talk unless my organ of speech was functioning, unless right thoughts occurred in my mind, unless all those things happen, this act of speaking could not have. And therefore, all that grace is always there. So unless Ishvara's grace is there, nothing can be done. It's true. But you can't say that I have no involvement in it at all. Because if I talk just anything and everything and say something which is all wrong and bad, then I am certainly responsible also. So I can't say it's no responsibility. It's there. And so how much is free will? How much is Ishvara's will? So it is very difficult or not possible for us to determine the dividing line. All we can say is that in every situation, there is free will as well as Ishvara's will. Both are required to make anything happen. Merely Ishvara's will also, not if I just sit like that, you know, that also won't work. Some free will or self-effort is required. Well, it's only self-effort. How can you make self-effort unless Ishvara's will is there? That is also true. But at the same time, there's a difference between my not doing anything and doing something. So some kind of self-effort is there. And so there is free will. There's no free will, there's no responsibility. No responsibility, then there's nothing right and wrong. If there's nothing right and wrong, then there's no dharma, dharma. In that case, there's no growth at all. So that I can help myself, hurt myself both, is because of free will. And so there is free will. Meaning that we have a responsibility and accountability for what we do. So we should accept the free will in that sense. But at the same time, what the outcome comes is all Ishvara's will. So put it this way, free will is in performing action and Ishvara's will in determining the outcome of the action. So karmanyavadikaraste, use your free will in performing what is right. Mahaphaleshu kadashana, it is my will that I will decide what the outcome will be. So, in short, free will and Ishvara's will. But as one used to say that, in every situation, what is given to me is Ishvara's will, and the way I respond to it is free will.
Swamiji, Ishvara used the power of Kala, which is... Is it fair to say it's time? Meaning to devour...
Kala is time or Kala is death, both. Because time devours everything.
Exactly. So my thought was that anyway everybody's going to die. both the armies are going to die because due to time at some point. And just who the players are that...
Yeah, but there is no waiting for them to die at their time. This, I will decide when they are going to die, like Lord Krishna says. I have decided that all of them are going to die now, within 18 days. In that sense, he is the Kala or the principle of death. Time wears away, everything, no doubt about that. But when time presents itself as a specific destruction, you know, you call it death. Pujya Swamiji explained very well problems arising from human ignorance. But how do I understand Ishvara? When I witness hurt caused by natural disasters like floods and earthquakes created by a loving God, how is it that loving God creates this kind of disasters of floods and earthquakes that bring the world so much of hurt and destruction and death? What kind of loving God is that? Isn't it? So should we say no earthquake should take place? Is earthquake a disaster? Or is it a blessing? Earthquake is a need of the nature. If earthquakes do not happen, the earth will split apart. So earthquake is a requirement to release all the pent-up energy. So all these natural phenomena are required to happen. If they do not happen, then they will cause more destruction than... Right now, they are not causing destruction. Earthquake is not meant to cause any destruction. If we were chosen to be where the earthquake takes place, and then we complain that we are destroyed. Recently, I was in some place, and my hostess, I say, what happened to you? I'm here. Swamiji, I got burnt by the steam coming from the steam cooker. So she was blowing something and the steam came out from that thing. Her hand happened to be there. So can we blame the steam? Hey steam, you are cruel. You burned my hand. Or I chose to place my hand there when the steam was coming or whatever. You know, can we blame the steam? I mean, if my hand touches fire and gets burned, can we blame fire? Fire is simply following its nature, that whatever comes in contact will burn. Say fire is law, God has created fire. Fire is required. If it's not, then the world will not survive. So all floods are required. All hurricanes are required. Everything is required to release various forces of nature. If there is not there, then something else will burst. And so everything is required. But it's like a steam thing, you know, when those, what do you call them, the... Volcano. Like the steam cooker, there's a safety valve, really. All energy is spent up and you have a safety valve. Oh, but you just destroyed so many villages. Why did you build something there? It's not nature's fault that it does what it does. It does only to protect things. What we call natural disasters are all phenomena. You have to ask the scientists, that's all. As to the need of those so-called disasters to happen. In fact, they say that there is an earthquake every 4 minutes someplace in the earth. Fortune, most of them take place in the ocean, so we don't even know. And they may not be strong enough for us to feel them. If they are not there, earth cannot survive. Energy has to be released. If there is no release, then it will burst. So volcanoes also are required. Earthquakes also are required. Or hurricanes also are required. Or storms are required. Everything is required for maintaining a harmony or balance in nature. We have chosen to build our houses in the way of
Fault line.
Fault line, yeah. or the tornadoes and things like that, you know. So they come and wipe out everything. A tornado is, you know, a chakravaka, they say. Just wipes out like a milling machine. It's very sad for that. But then, this is required. If you study the nature, if you understand, then we know that this is required to happen. It is not that God says, okay, now this shows a builder, I'll let me destroy them. That is not His will. Meaning is, this will is not that I'm going to create the earthquake and make, look at these fellows, you know, I'll punish them. If that is the intention of God, then you can say it's cruel. But all these, even so-called disaster, is our nomenclature of that phenomenon, because it doesn't suit us, that's all. But the earthquakes that happen in the ocean, nobody calls them disasters. And the floods that happen on the island where nobody lives, nobody calls them disasters. We call some phenomenon disaster and some not disaster. It's all our nomenclature that suits us. So to brand God as this and that, just because it does not suit us, I mean, I don't think it's fair to God that to say it's cruel or something. So create a loving God. Loving God only creates, whatever He creates is for our well-being. But well-being is not always pleasant sometimes, I guess. So the medicines also are given for well-being. They can be very bitter also. And so. But they say that this, we call them disasters. But they are all the phenomenon, the natural phenomenon. As long as they don't hurt us, we don't call it disaster. So the breeze is there, we call it good because it helps us, you know. So that is loving God. But the 110 degrees temperature is a cruel God because it doesn't suit us. So we have our own way of branding everything. What suits us and what doesn't. Once I attain moksha and am alive with this body, I am no longer a jiva. Would I be one with Brahman and become all-knowing while still having this body and mind complex? Will I be one with Brahman? You are one with Brahman. Not that you will be. If you are not one with Brahman, you cannot become. You cannot become what you are not. And so it is not that you will become one with Brahman, you will recognize that you were always one with Brahman. Not that I became one with Brahman. That is also not so. That means you are not so far one with Brahman. No. Recognition is, I just did not know that I was a tenth man. Not that I become tenth man. Now, when I discovered, I always was. So you don't become Brahman. You recognize that you are Brahman. Then I become all-knowing. Now, knowledge is function not of Brahman, but knowledge function of the mind, understand? Therefore, even for a wise man, as far as knowledge is concerned, it is only whatever it is that a given mind can produce. You don't become all-knowing in the sense that you know every leaf and every star and every grain of sand. That kind of all-knowledge doesn't happen. Nor is it required to happen. It's better that it doesn't happen. Otherwise, we'll go crazy. If I know every source happening, we'll just go crazy. Well, it's not. You know, we're happy with what we have, really. Mere fascination and some kind of really romanticism with all knowledge, we don't know what it means. If it happens, then what will happen? So it's better that we are where we are as far as this body, mind, sense complex is concerned. So no. By becoming a wise person, you don't become all-knowing in that sense. But in a sense, you also become. Just as there are two forms of knowledge when it comes to a cloth. One is that it is cloth. Other is that it is cotton. Now, cotton is what we call the samanya jnanam, or the essential knowledge of the cloth. And what is the length of the cloth and what is the make of this? All of this is vishesha jnanam, or particular knowledge. So when you know the cloth is cotton, then you own all the cloth in as much as the essential nature of every cloth is cotton. In that sense, you own all the cloths. But in as much as every cloth also has its own length and width and stuff like that, you don't know that. So wise person knows everything, in as much as he knows in essence that everything is Brahman or everything is a self. But that doesn't mean when you are born and what your weight is, etc., that he doesn't know. And thank God that he doesn't know. I don't think anybody would want to know this kind of stuff anyway. I don't think I would want to be bothered with that thing, you know. Because what will you do with that? Suppose you have, what will you do with that? Why is there so much attraction to know everything? That kind of knowledge, I don't know. Anyway, no, you will not know. Time management. How and what to prioritize? How and what to prioritize? That depends upon what it is that you're looking for. The priority depends upon what it is that we want to achieve, what our objective is. So, what it is that is most effective in achieving my goal becomes more important. So, you prioritize that which is most important to you, which is the means of achieving your goal, depending on what your goal is. You want to be a millionaire? Then priority of one kind. You want to be a Vedic Pandita? The priority of a different kind. You want to be a Vedantic scholar? A third kind. You want to be a wise person? A fourth kind. Depends on what you want to become. So there cannot be an answer, specific answer, what to prioritize. However, I presume that the one who is asking this question, for that person the priority is of knowledge, let us say. Then you prioritize, give importance to, if knowledge is most important, then the means of gaining that knowledge also becomes important. So then if that means that you should expose yourself to teaching, that's important. For all the time you cannot have somebody to teach you, then you listen at your home, then mananam. So, shravanam, mananam, nididhyasanam, that is most important. If knowledge is your goal, then of course you have to live your life, you have to eat and drink and stuff like that. So all of that is there so that it supports what you want to do. If shravanam, mananam is important to you, then you eat for shravanam, not for eating. And for mananam. You eat for eating, then you can't do shravanam, you know. So, once what is most important for me is desired, then everything is always around that. See, in Gujarat, you know, what will be the kind of dishes that will be cooked? Depends on what is the dessert or sweet dish. Because in Gujarat, they begin with sweet, the middle is sweet, and end is sweet. Therefore, what else is cooked, it all goes with that. If there is a thing called shikhand, you know, which is made from yogurt, then there will be one kind of menu. If there is sweet made of milk, another kind of menu. Sweet made from flour, wheat flour, third kind of menu, you know. So what do you cook depends on what is the important thing there. So Gujarati, that is the most important thing. And everything revolves around that. Similarly, what you do all revolves around what it is that is important to you. And everything revolves around that. That's how the priorities are decided. And in priority, what do you eat first? Now that also depends upon Gujaratis eat that thing first, in the middle, in the end. Other things are all secondary, you know. So depends on what is important for you, that's how you prioritize. Any significance to the name Nachiketa? So far I have not been able to discover that, you know, the meaning of Nachiketa, as to what it is made up of. And somebody did ask this question to me and I thought of investigating, but that has not happened. So I don't know what the meaning word Nachiketa is. Although it is a fire, it's the name of a fire. Because Nachiketa pleased Lord Yama and therefore he gave the ritual which is called Nachiketa. So if you look in the dictionary, Nachiketa means fire. That's the name of a fire. But that Nachiketa word doesn't mean fire. But because a given kind of fire is named after Nachiketa, therefore you can say Indra means God. Now, Indra doesn't mean God. Indra happens in the name of a God, you follow? Indra happens in the name of a God. So, if you say dictionary, Indra is God, name of God. But it's because a God is named Indra. So, a fire is named Nachiketa. What Nachiketa itself means, we'll have to find out. I don't know. I have to remember again to go into that. So, I will tap my resources tonight as to what's been in the Nachiketa. Hopefully, I will tell you if they return me to me the answer. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says to Arjuna, you are not the doer, I am the doer. Same question came from the same person, I don't know. If that is the case, then why are we responsible for our karma? If God is doer, then why are we responsible for the karma? What does this say or mean about the law of karma? If God does everything, then we are not responsible. That's good, we are not responsible. That's what God wants. There is no responsibility. That is called mukti, freedom. Actually, moksha means the freedom from responsibility. Freedom from is free will. Freedom from exercising free will is called the freedom. Because free will means there is an agenda. And real freedom is freedom or agenda. And no agenda, then there is no need to exercise free will. No free will, no responsibility. That is called liberation. But that takes a long time. Today, you have to take responsibility to become free from responsibility. That's the thing, you know. So Lord Krishna says, na karmana manarambhat nishkarmyam kuru. Hey Arjuna, by not taking responsibility for this karma, don't think that you will become free from karma. You do the karma to become free from karma. And so we have to take responsibility to discover that we have no responsibility. You follow? Even though Lord Krishna says to Arjuna that I am doing everything, but it has to become Arjuna's knowledge. That's what Lord Krishna says. Arjuna can repeat, I am not doing, but it should mean that I am not doing. So when Arjuna discovers his true nature, then he realizes I am not doing. That's fine. But for him to discover I am not doing, a lot of things have to be done. And done properly, with the right attitudes. So that's called the yoga. Is there symbolism behind saying eating progeny, eating wealth, eating punya? So he said that the divine voice told Nachiketa that Yamaraja will ask you, what did you eat the first day? Your progeny. What did you eat the next day? Your wealth. Cattle. That's wealth. What did you eat the third day? Your virtue or punya. So this is what he said. In fact, we have not included all the verses of Kathopanishad. But a verse in Kathopanishad says, where the attendants of Lord Yama tells him, reminds him, that look, this Brahmana has come, he's fire. Hungry Brahmana is fire. So better take care, you know, when somebody, Brahmana, you can remember, hungry person is fire. When he comes to your home, then he can destroy everything. But a hungry Brahmana can destroy you. And so he describes your progeny, destroys your wealth, destroys your punya. So what fire consumes? So this fire in the form of this hungry Brahmana, what does he consume? He'll consume all of this. Meaning that all of that you earn as a result of your punya karma will all go away. If this person, if he's upset with you, his anger or his, can destroy everything. That's the way of saying. So, all of these are results of our punya karma. The progeny also is a result of punya karma. Wealth also is. So when you say punya karma, it means punya karma for the next world. So two kinds of punya karma is there. One kind of punya karma of virtuous deeds which give me wealth and prosperity in this world. Other kind of punya karma that gives me the happiness in the other world. Two kinds of punya karma are there. So this progeny and wealth are result of punya karma which are meant to give me the happiness in this world, and simply punya karma are those which are meant to give me happiness in other world. Meaning that whatever you acquire for enjoyment in this world, other world, is all will be gone. You know, so that is what is meant here.
See, Swami, that is then the actual text. The three things get destroyed.
Yeah. It is in the Taittiriya Brahmana. So we will tell you the reference. How do we experience peace and calm throughout our waking hours as a Vedanta student? Why as a Vedanta student? You would like to experience peace and calm, you know. Not only a Vedanta student. How do you experience peace and calm? So we have to ask, what's the reason why I'm not experiencing peace and calm? Peace and calm happens to be the essential nature of mind. And therefore, if you stop disturbing the mind, it will be at peace. Like the nature of water surface is calmness. Keep on throwing pebble in there, then you know all kinds of wrinkles and ripples are created. So we create the ripples, do you follow? We find ripples in water, it's something that we are creating. Similarly also we find this restlessness and disturbance etc. in the mind, we are creating it. So you have to stop creating. How do we create? By raga and dvesha, simple attachment and aversion. You know, so by that we create. Attachment also creates disturbance in the mind, aversion also creates disturbance in the mind. So how do we remain with peace and calm? By becoming free from them, getting rid of them. It's a big thing though. The thing is, for enjoying peace and calm, we should get rid of those factors which disturb the mind and create restlessness, which are simply stated as raga and dvesha, attachment and aversion. Vedantins always come back to this ultimately, because that's what Gita teaches, you know. Ultimately, all kama, krodha, you know, reduced to these two things, raga and dvesha, attachment and aversion. Both of them disturb our mind, make our mind disturb, restless. To enjoy them, become free from that. How do you get rid of them? By cultivating the right values and attitudes. So non-violence is a value, truthfulness is a value, compassion is a value. So being, a contributor is a value or an attitude. So by deliberately cultivating these values and attitudes, we drive away or subdue these raga dveshas.
Is that how you also purify your mind?
Yeah. So raga dveshas are there for whatever reasons, for what we did in the past. So now we deliberately do something so that the raga dveshas do not get further nurtured or nourished, and then slowly are subdued and removed. So karma yoga is for that purpose. Perform your actions with the attitude of yoga. Attitude of being a contributor. So that's the means of slowly getting rid of the raga dveshas. What's the difference between the meditation on an idol or a symbol and guided meditation where our mind is engaged in listening, thinking, contemplating and not focused on anything? So, we can say there are two kinds of meditations. One is meditating upon something other than myself, on Ishvara, in one way or the other. And other is a meditation, in the words of our Swamiji, is meditation upon the meditator. So these guided meditations, our Swami used to call them the reality meditation. So generally in guided meditation, we meditate upon what is, what I am, or what the world is, what the order is. So you'll find in guided meditation the topic will be on what is. What's the order of the universe? Or what's the nature of myself? So this will be the topic. And therefore the guided meditations are meditating upon, let us say, the reality of life. And the reality of ourselves, or reality of Ishvara, reality of the world, universe. Whereas meditating upon a symbol or a murti, is a meditation upon Ishvara through that prop in the form of prayer, in the form of worship. So one is meditation of the nature of mental worship, which is what normally is called meditation. What normally Vedanta would call meditation. There are many types of meditations. But the kind of meditation that we prefer is a meditation of the nature of mental worship. And that is why we generally have a symbol or something that invokes in our mind a devotee. The purpose of having what you call murti is to invoke from me a devotee. And so what will invoke the devotee depends upon a person. Whatever it is that invokes in you a devotee, use that symbol, use that name, So, one is meditating as a devotee. Second is meditating upon the devotee. So, meditating upon the meditator. So, in the guided meditation, usually it is meditation on what Swami used to call reality meditation. So meditation upon, you are made to see what is. So, one is meditation upon imagining or visualizing what is not, and second is meditation upon seeing what is. So, this guided meditation usually is seeing what is. Looks like three questions for one person. Alright. What is the significance of Abhishekam? Abhishekam means bathing the Lord. So when you pour some liquid or fluid upon the murti, Abhishekam like Rudra Abhishekam. So pouring water or milk or any such material upon the Shivalinga is called Abhishekha. It can be any deity. Abhishekha can be upon any deity. Although Rudra Abhishekha is most famous, but every deity is bathed. That's called Abhishekha. Why do we do that? This is one of the steps to give him bath. And give him bath with different materials. So we don't know right now, but there was a time when all the royalty, the kings and, you know, those people used to take baths with this kind of material. Each one of them has an effect on the body. And so water has some effect, curd has some effect, milk has some effect, ghee has some effect. There are 11 kinds of materials with which we offer baths to Lord Shiva. Each one of them also has some physical effect. So, I mean, that we are treating Lord with the best thing that we have. And so that he has the best experience. That's the idea. And then supposedly there is also a result or reward for each kind of Abhishekha. There is a list of what happens when you do Abhishekha with milk and with curd and with this and what the result is. But significant Abhishekha is giving bath to the Lord. Make him happy. Whatever you do is to make him happy. Invite him, give him a nice seat, make him happy. Wash his feet, make him happy. Give him bath, make him happy. Nice garments, nice ornaments, flowers. Just to make him happy, that's all the purpose is. To please him. Because that's the purpose of worship, to please God. I mean, God also needs to please, please with me. He's pleased in general, but I want him to please with me. That's why we do that. I have faced death of family and friends from childhood. Father at 12, grandfather at 18, few in India, few after moving here. With maturity, I expect the impact to be lesser. But my experience is opposite. A part of me dies with every disappearing connection. A part of me dies with every disappearing connection. How do you manage Pujya Swamiji's Mahasamadhi? Now that's the putting on, you know, to the person. Depends on the connection, that is true. Stronger the physical connection, greater the loss. Stronger the emotional connection, also the loss. Stronger the intellectual connection, a little less. Depends on your connection. And how much emotional dependence has been. But we were always taught to become independent. So Pujya Swamiji always taught us to become independent. Not independent in terms of, you know, don't care kind of thing. Independent in terms of becoming independent emotionally. Not remain dependent. Discover that freedom. So, therefore, as far as emotional dependence is concerned, there was much growing out of it overall course of this time. So therefore, that kind of vacuum that you feel in, and so you can say that Swamiji in some sense is always with us. But as far as that presence is concerned, yes. But in course of time, we were becoming slowly and slowly free from the dependence upon that presence. In that sense, then it becomes relatively easier to be able to deal with that. But otherwise very difficult. Very difficult. What is the difference between I am Brahman, you are Brahman, we are all Brahman, and we are all one? What's the difference? I am Brahman, you are Brahman, we are all Brahman, we are all one. What's the difference? No difference. Well, I happens to be you and you happens to be we and we happens to be one. And then all the statements, idea amount to the same thing. When we realize what Brahman is, then it all amounts to the same thing. Because, as you say, in Brahman or in the truth, then I-ness and you-ness no more remains. Right now we are confining the Brahman to I-ness and you-ness. When that confinement is not there, then the concept of I and you and we itself slowly and slowly has no significance as far as Brahman is concerned. Completeness versus oneness, difference, please. Completeness is oneness, because there cannot be completeness when there are two. Each one will limit the other one. With 100% trust, faith in the Guru, in the material, I guess material means perhaps the text and things like that, that's what it meant by material. Is knowledge of Sanskrit still required? Can Shraddha compensate for lack of Sanskrit knowledge? I can't say Sanskrit is necessarily required. I can't. No, not really. Usually our Swamis make up for the lack of knowledge of Sanskrit on the part of listeners. So we can't say that it is necessarily required. If you pay attention to what we are listening to class, it should be quite adequate. But at the same time, this should not be a justification of my not making an effort to only learn Sanskrit also, by the way. I should not seek justification to try to learn Sanskrit also. Whereas not knowing Sanskrit is okay, but doesn't mean that there is justification of not making an effort to know. Well, better. If you know Sanskrit, it becomes better. Because in the words, and teacher is going to explain all the words, so it, even if you don't know, it's not going to make, it's not, you know. And it's not the language really, it is what the language conveys that is important, that's knowledge. So I cannot say that knowledge of Sanskrit is essential. But if I were you, then I would make an attempt to learn as much as I can so that the texts make a little more sense to me. The words make a little more sense to me without being translated also. But no, don't feel that because you do not know Sanskrit that you will miss something or that you cannot get the knowledge. No, I would not say that. Okay, our course is complete. So we'll conclude with one bhajan. That's what we always do there also, right? Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Gajavadana Gananatha Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Gajavadana Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak He Shubhadayak He Shubhadayak Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gunalaya Gauri Varatanaya Gajavadana Gananatha Natha Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Vidyadayak Buddhi Pradayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak Siddhi Vinayak He Shubhadayak He Shubhadayak He Shubhadayak Siddhi Vinayak शुभदायक
सिद्धिविनायक हे शुभदायक
गजवदनागणनाथनाथ गजवदनागणनाथ नाथ
गजवदनागणनाथ नाथ
गौरीवरतनया गुणालया गौरीवरतनया गुणालया गजवदनागणनाथनाथ विद्यादायक बुद्धिप्रदायक विद्यादायक बुद्धिप्रदायक सिद्धिविनायक हे शुभदायक
सिद्धिविनायक हे शुभदायक
सिद्धिविनायक हे शुभदायक
सिद्धिविनायक हे शुभदायक
हे शुभदायक गजवदनागणनाथनाथ गजवदनागणनाथनाथ सर्वे भवन्तु सुखिनः सर्वे सन्तु निरामयाः सर्वे भद्राणि पश्यन्तु मा कश्चित् दुःखभाग् भवेत् असतो मा सत्यमय तमसो मा ज्योतिर्गमय मृत्योर्मा अमृतं गमय ॐ पूर्णमदः पूर्णमिदम् पूर्णात् पूर्णमुदच्छते पूर्णस्य पूर्णमादाय पूर्णमेवावशिष्यते ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः हरि ॐ श्रीगुरुभ्यो नमः हरि ॐ